lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp foggy midnight,
you're listening to episode 697 of Unwelcome Guests, the estimable Russ Baker. I'm Robin Upton, and Russ Baker, you may recall, we've mentioned his name a couple of times on the show, and he's been a small contributor to a couple of the videos from which we've made episodes, but we haven't featured any dedicated pieces by Russ Baker, which is quite remarkable, actually, considering his success at Unmasking the Deep State, Mark Gordon's theories about a cabal at the heart of the American government. The Deep State draw quite heavily on research by Russ Baker and his allies. So I thought we'll have a whole show on Russ Baker. We've got two pieces. This is actually 2.5 hours of material squeezed down into 2 hours, but I've only removed commercials and other distractions, a few hesitations. Our second longer interview is by Bonnie Faulkner from Guns and Butter. That's from 5 years ago, but Russ Baker continues his researches, and we're going to begin with a half-hour interview from May 2014. So thanks to Mike McCormack from Talking Stick TV. Here's the soundtrack of that video.
Time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Russ Baker. Russ Baker is an investigative journalist. He is founder and editor-in-chief of WhoWhatWhy.com. He has written for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Nation, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Village Voice, and Esquire, and numerous other publications. He has also served as a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and he is the author of the book Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. Russ, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
It's my pleasure.
So start out, tell us a bit about WhoWhatWhy.com.
Sure. After many years in journalism, I began to consciously note that there were topics I couldn't cover. There were depths I wanted to go to that I was unable to, and so I decided it was time for a new sort of journalism. Who, What, Why is a nonprofit. We are nonpartisan. I like to call it nonpartisan but fierce, meaning we really want to know what happened, what is happening, and what will happen, and we will go to whatever lengths we can to figure that out. We try to focus on what we think are the biggest stories facing humanity. We try to focus on stories that we think other news organizations will not touch, either because it doesn't fit their particular orthodoxy or because it is just a little bit too sensitive for them. And so we've been starting Who, What, Why kind of gradually for a number of years, you might say. And it's been growing terrifically with a combination of staff and volunteers. We're on the web at whowhatwhy.com. We're technically a .org. We don't take any ads, don't take any corporate money, and we rely, I guess, like this station entirely on our audience.
How do you select your staff and writers?
Complicated formula, I would say. We look for people who think outside the box, who are more interested in learning than they are in opining. We look for people who are very intelligent and well-read, but also go into every single story with an open mind. And so we've got an interesting mix. I mean, certainly on the journalistic side of what we do, meaning the actual writers and editors, they tend to be people who have been professional journalists. Although we find that a lot of the best people were not professional journalists. They may have been biologists or chemists or almost anything, lawyers, and they bring the skills of that particular discipline to the stories. And so we've got, I think we're kind of an amazing experiment, which is, I don't think has been tried before, which is to, it happens in radio, let's say, in shows like this, but in sort of print journalism or online journalism, it is rare to give that kind of an opportunity to people who have not been formally schooled in it, but who really have a natural instinct.
And so they might also not necessarily be socialized as much as, let's say, a lot of the corporate media journalists are.
That's right. And so they're often willing to kind of look at stories in a different way.
All right. So one of the subjects that you have been focusing on for just a year now, because we also are just seeing the anniversary of, is the Boston bombing. So talk about that, maybe for those who can't remember specifics on it, kind of give us an overview and then.
Sure. Just to set the context, at Who, What, Why, we look a lot at the security state. We look a lot at the growing role of the military-industrial complex, to use one classical term. We look a lot at the role of fear in our society, in government, in what we are told we need to be concerned about. We look a lot at propaganda. We look at budget priorities. We look at changes in textures, say, for example, the militarization of our police, rollback of privacy and civil liberties. These are very important to us. And I've, throughout my career, covered the CIA, to some extent the FBI, and so forth. And so I've always been interested in their activities. And with the Boston Marathon bombing, that fit a pattern of what I guess you could call sort of major traumatic events that cause fundamental changes, many of which we don't even notice at the time. And in the case of the Boston Marathon bombing, it was this sort of astonishing lockdown of a major American city, people ordered to remain in their homes. And although there was a brief flurry of commentary, there really was no vigorous discussion about what was going on. Was this justified? Was this legal? And where could this kind of thing be headed in the long run? And so we began right from that first week in April of 2013, looking at the Boston Marathon bombing, trying to understand really everything about it, including why it was that the authorities were so keen on assuring us that they had solved this crime so fast and that there was nothing else to look at. And over the years, I've looked at other major events like Iran-Contra and Watergate and the assassinations of major leaders from John F. Kennedy to Martin Luther King, and have always been struck by the certitude of particularly the FBI in assuring us that they immediately knew who had done it. And, you know, it's that old saying, nothing to see here, folks, move along, move along. And we were troubled by that. We're always troubled by that. And in the case of Boston, we began seeing anomalies, Mike, right from the beginning, things that didn't add up, stories that changed. This is kind of a theme at Who, What, Why. We see so often, we see it with the death or the purported death of Osama bin Laden, the way they said, we threw the body in the ocean, nothing to see, no, you know, nothing to look at. That's it. No, we can't show you photos. Oh, the video feed went out. So the people in the White House couldn't see what was going on. You know, you can't talk to people who were involved. This is very, very common. And to, I think, an open-minded person, it's very suspicious. It's not really normal. And the Boston bombing is just an astonishing, I'd call it a kind of a deep politics event in real time. It's a case of the security services immediately creating a narrative, almost a kind of a mythology based on inadequate investigation. It was very, very clear to us that they really had not investigated all the possibilities. And the other interesting thing is the way that the key witnesses in all of these situations, you'd think you'd want Osama bin Laden alive and to interrogate him. You'd think that extraordinary efforts would have been made to just capture both of these brothers and get them to talk. But in what happened in the Boston bombing case was the first brother was killed. The second brother, it looks like an attempted kill because he was unarmed and they fired more than 100 shots into the boat in which he was hiding. And then a third fellow, a friend of the elder brother living down in Florida, being interviewed by the FBI and then shot and killed unarmed again in a room while being, you know, interviewed. So we find these things important, and we think that they need to be carefully investigated.
So let's stick on that subject for a bit. Talk about what incidents or items really set you off in terms of asking questions. One of them is the lead guy that so much is based on, his testimony.
I mean, basically, in most of these stories, we don't really remember how it came to be that we know what we know, but we think we know what happened. If you ask most people, they say these two brothers, the Tsarnaevs, did it. We know that they planted the bombs. We know that they made the bombs. We know all of these things, and we believe that they confessed. And so it's very interesting that I talk to extremely intelligent, educated people who tell me that, oh, I've seen video of them planting the bomb, but actually we haven't seen video of them planting the bomb. And there are tremendous leaks from law enforcement, which themselves are very, very suspect because there's an upcoming trial of the younger brother. These leaks are highly improper. They're unfair, and they prejudice the public and really the whole legal system against the defendant, which is not the American way. So we were told all these things. There have been leaks saying, that you can see them putting the backpacks down. They've released some stills. We'll have some things to say about that on Who, What, Why as to the reliability of those photos. They haven't released video of somebody actually putting it down. But one of the key elements in there, I think what you were referring to, Mike, is that we are told that several days after the bombing, the FBI announced at 5 p.m. on Thursday of that week, the bombing was on a Monday, they suddenly put up stills from video, and they said, these are suspects or persons of interest. If anybody knows who they are, please let us know. We don't know who they are. So it came out sometime later that the FBI did know who these people were and, in fact, had been interacting with the elder brother for a while, several years earlier, as a possible terrorist suspect. So it struck us that they were very quick to say, we don't know who these guys are. And it took the Russians in a very strange situation. The Russians said, well, you do know who they are because we warned you about them some years ago. And then the FBI was forced to then admit that it had actually interacted with and been dealing with and been in and out of the house of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. But then sometime later that evening, suddenly we heard police officer down, there's shooting, and there was a dead police officer at MIT. We were quickly told that it was probably these brothers who had done it. That gave me a little bit of a chill of recognition because in my work, looking at the Kennedy assassination, it was a similar situation where you could not really connect Lee Harvey Oswald with the shots fired at the motorcade. But then shortly after that, a police officer was shot somewhere else. They said that, you know, Oswald had done it and that he had dropped his wallet. It was all very, very neat. And then this pointed him back to the fact that he worked at the book depository. In this case, it was almost identical. And we were told that they had shot this police officer. We've looked at that, and there are real doubts as to whether they would have had the motivation, whether they would have been in that location, or what evidence there is. But even more interestingly, later that evening, we heard that there was a carjacking and that the victim escaped, ran across the street from one gas station to another. Police and FBI were on the scene literally in several minutes. They were very fast to respond. And we are told that this this carjacking victim explained to them that he had been carjacked by a man who was later identified as Tamerlan Tsarnaev. And he said to that the man not only had a gun, which you'd think would be sufficient motivation to do what he said, but that he actually said to him, "Do you know who I am? I am the bomber of the Boston Marathon, and I also just shot a cop." Now, that just struck me as a little bit odd, because if, in fact, Tamerlan Tsarnaev's purpose was to lay low and to get out of town, adding that element to the fact you already had a gun just seems extraneous. And so we were interested in this so-called confession, because this is the basis for the public believing that they definitely were behind these things. And we were struck by the fact that we've never to this day been introduced to this carjacking victim. They used a nickname for him, put him on camera without us seeing his face. Recently, they've started showing his face a little bit, but they still are not telling us who he is. And I tried through intermediaries to have access to him, because I wanted to ask him specific questions about inconsistencies in his own accounts, and I've been denied that access. He did several media interviews early on. They were softball interviews. They didn't really attempt to elicit information from him. It was more of a kind of an affirmation of the official narrative. Softball, but his story is fascinating, Mike, because in different accounts, the length of the carjacking from an hour and a half down to 30 minutes down to 0 minutes. There are questions as to whether he said in the official account he was sitting in the car with one brother who had a gun, and he bolted out of the car when the fellow was distracted. We found another account where he told a television reporter that he was alone in the car, that they were outside of the car doing something else entirely when he escaped, which makes you wonder how ruthless they were and how competent they were, if they would just leave somebody who was a captive alone. And so all of these things raise questions as to what really happened, and whether this story that we're being told is credible.
Tell us, who's Jamie Foxx? He's one of the people you dealt with or tried to get an interview with?
Yeah. One of the stranger of many, many strange things on this story is the fact that this fellow nicknamed Danny has been sort of mentored or guided, and his media interviews sort of controlled and monitored by a professor of criminology at Northeastern University. And I was struck by the fact that, to me, a criminologist would be mostly interested in the crime and solving it, but this fellow seems mostly interested in sort of protecting the identity of this witness, and even kind of intervening in the interviews and sort of steering them. And I found that to be strange. Let me put it this way. I get the feeling on a lot of these stories that the security complex of this country is much larger than we understand, that academia, that all sorts of institutions, people within the media play roles in this. And if we look back historically, there has been such cooperation. On our website, whowhatwhy.com, I think it's still on the front page, an article by a very good journalist named Steve Weinberg, a review of a book about the FBI and its the cooperation of the media with the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover in crafting essentially a false image of the FBI for public consumption, creating this notion of this sort of invincible, highly competent, extremely principled outfit, which actually bore no resemblance to the truth at all. And so we see in that book the extent to which media figures were like PR people for the FBI. And on the Boston story, we see John Miller of CBS, a guy who himself was, you know, the head of public affairs for the FBI, and then he goes in and out of journalism, and he's the guy sitting there interviewing this Danny and just lobbing softballs at him. So there are real questions about academic figures and institutions, places like MIT, where this police officer was shot. MIT actually sent me a letter and told me to stop asking people questions on campus because they said it made people uncomfortable. And I thought, that's an institution of higher learning and higher inquiry. discovery. Well, you know, MIT takes a tremendous amount of money from the government, very closely associated with large corporations, involved in the so-called homeland security and the war industry.
Talk a little bit about some of the what you find are problems with the story around Sean Collier.
Yes. So that was the shooting on Thursday night. That's when all these events began happening very, very fast. And I believe that was the moment that this sort of potential myth was being created, this sort of certitude of, that it was just these two guys. They were lone wolves. By the way, we're always told that people are lone wolves, except in cases where they want to create a kind of an exaggerated international conspiracy, like with the idea of making al-Qaeda more than it may actually have been or be. But in this case, we were told initially that this very brave police officer, first responder, had shown up at a convenience store and or gas station and run into these two brothers, and that they had shot and killed him. If you ask the public now, many people heard that. People, you know, it's sort of that first impression that people, that stick with people. One of my favorite sayings is, a lie gets around the world before the truth can get its pants on. And so those first impressions are absolutely critical in what they call psyops, psychological operations to shape public perceptions. And then later on, after people were not paying much attention, it was like, oh, well, no, that report was wrong. He actually was shot while in his police car. And then it came out, well, he was sitting on this street in Boston, and they came up to him and shot him and took his gun. And then it turned out, oh, well, somebody shot him, but they didn't take his gun. And then I discovered that he wasn't on a street, that he was parked between buildings on the darkened MIT campus. And it wasn't near where they were, or there wasn't any clear reason why you would be on a darkened campus or even know that a police officer would be sitting in a police car between darkened buildings. I mean, that's not normal on campuses. And then they told us that he was there because it was routine that he would sit there and prevent people from making illegal right turns. And I went there, and there was no place there to make illegal right turns, and there was no traffic at that hour. So that clearly was just bogus. And the media has not followed up in the kinds of issues we've raised at Who, What, Why. They read our stuff, we know, because we hear from them. But they, for whatever reason, they cannot seem to ask a single good question of the authorities.
And talk a bit more about the friend or relation that was shot dead by the FBI in Florida.
Yeah, so there was a fellow named Ibrahim Todashev, who was a friend of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two brothers alleged to be behind the bombing and the shooting of the police officer. And he lived in Orlando, Florida, and as soon as the FBI and the Boston State Troopers discovered his existence and the fact that he was maybe the closest person with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, they were on a plane down to talk to him. They brought him in and had a number of interrogations. He was uncomfortable with what was going on, and he told a friend that he felt that they were trying to force some sort of information that was not even true to get him to say some things, to possibly even confess to something. He had a sense they were trying to figure out what he knew about the Boston bombing, what he knew about Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and even what he knew about Tamerlan Tsarnaev's past dealings with the FBI. That he felt that there was some sort of a mop-up going on, and they interviewed him several times. The final time they interviewed him, he told a friend that he was scared that something bad was going to happen. He asked a friend to come over and be there at his apartment. The FBI kept him outside and eventually made the friend leave and go to a restaurant somewhere, and they said, "We'll bring your friend when we're finished." Against regulations, there was only one FBI agent in the room. They're supposed to always be true because the FBI has this very strange thing where when they extract confessions, they never tape record. They never film. Very odd, very anachronistic. But they always have to have an extra officer there to supposedly witness this. In this case, something supposedly went wrong. He confessed to involvement in a triple homicide involving some low-level drug dealers in the greater Boston area some years earlier, and that he supposedly confessed that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was involved. But then apparently right after giving them this confession, he supposedly went berserk and lunged at them, and the FBI agent shot him and killed him. And it's all odd because they're trained. If somebody comes at you, you shoot them in the leg or you apprehend them some other way. It's all a very, very strange story. They told multiple versions. They leaked and they kept changing it. What happened, that this fellow came at them with a ceremonial sword, that he came at them with a baseball bat, that he grabbed, I think it was the leg of a table. And then later we find out, they make a big deal of the fact that he did Y-Crew martial arts, but we later find out that he just had serious knee surgery and he was hobbled. We later find out, look at the crime scene photos, a pool of blood heading toward a hallway, not even where the table is, which kind of looks like he may have been heading toward the door when he was shot. And so all of these things raise very, very serious questions about whether we can trust what the FBI tells us. And of course, historically, we know that in the FBI's internal investigations of hundreds of shootings of people by FBI agents, they, in 100% of the cases, they said they were justified. I mean, that can't be true in any situation.
So the inevitable question and challenge would be to a lot of people listening would be, well, what, you're a conspiracy theorist. Why aren't you a conspiracy theorist?
Well, first of all, I would love to study that term. And in fact, I have. That term was suggested by the Central Intelligence Agency as a tactic to discourage discussion of particular topics. This was in the years after the Kennedy assassinations, plural. And there's a lot of discussion. There was a man working for Barack Obama, a Harvard professor, who was very big on discouraging people from discussing and speculating. He had this idea that they should have cognitive infiltration of chat rooms and online discussions about these kinds of deeper issues where people are suspicious of governmental statements claiming that these things are very, very harmful. And so there is a deliberate attempt to I would say pejoratize and minimize and divert attention from people who make serious inquiries into these kinds of things by trying to sort of lump them in with people who may be nuts. And it's a broad and an unfortunate term. It doesn't actually even mean anything, because the term conspiracy theorist or conspiracy theory relates to conspiracies, which is two or more people working together, planning and executing some kind of a crime. It is a criminal category that is being prosecuted as we speak in thousands of cases. The FBI routinely accuses people of being conspiracists. And so a theory is how we think about things. So conspiracy theory is how we think about two or more people getting together to commit a crime. It's a completely a non-judgmental term that has been turned into one that, when applied to anyone, is intended to just end conversation. It's kind of like saying, I don't know if you want to invite that person to the dinner party, she smells. And it's really a very problematical thing that we need to look at every time somebody uses that term.
All right, just about 2 minutes left. So you had mentioned that you're working on other forthcoming articles related to the Boston Marathon bombing. What can we expect coming out here in the near future?
Yeah, we're going to have more articles on that, I hope, every few weeks. It's very time and labor intensive. It's very difficult investigative work. It is the kind of thing that we pride ourselves on. It's the reason I created whowhatwhy.com. It's the reason I wrote my book, Family of Secrets, which I spent 5 years on, investigating the rise of the Bush family, consistently relevant now with Jeb Bush making noises that he's going to run for president as a third Bush. You got a fourth Bush Jeb's son has just been elected to office in Texas. What do these dynasties mean? What are their relationships to the 1% of the 1%, the military-industrial complex and the CIA and the banks and so forth? This is the kind of things that we look at. We welcome people to come to our site, to read Family of Secrets, to become involved in whatever way they'd like, to support our work. We're a tax-deductible nonprofit. We've got a Twitter feed at Who What Why. We've got a Facebook page, Who What Why. We're going to stay on this story. We're going to stay on as many more stories as we can within the constraints of what is possible.
With that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
George W., I'm one of your biggest fans, but I do have one little problem. When you walked into the party, we Republicans liked you a lot. But when reporters say you have a wild past, they're putting us on the spot.
I can assure you there's no sex affairs, but some stuff I forgot. I can't recall, was there schnapps in my coffee? Schnapps in my coffee.
Oh, you're so vague. We just don't know a darn thing about you. You're so vague.
So vague.
I just don't think this song is about me. About me, about me. Well, 10 or 20 years ago, perhaps it was even more, I may have done some coke, although I've been off that stuff since age 4.
But you know, since you've been governor, you've locked kids up for less.
I got a hero whose torch I can carry, Mary and Barry.
It's your cocaine.
If none of the voters remember the cocaine. I'll win by a nose next November. Won't I? Won't I? Hey, is there going to be a straw poll? Because I brought my own straw.
And that was You're So Vague by Capital Steps. Now, for our main piece this week, this is an extended interview of Russ Baker by none other than Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter, and the interview was first broadcast in May 2009.
I'm going to go ahead and read one of the blurbs on the dust jacket of Family of Secrets that gives a good description of your book. Quote, shocking in its disclosures, elegantly crafted and faultlessly measured in its judgments, Family of Secrets is nothing less than a first historic portrait in full of the Bush dynasty and the era it shaped. From revelation to revelation, insight to insight, from the Kennedy assassination to Watergate, to the oil and financial intrigues that lie behind today's headlines, this is a sweeping drama of money and power, unforeseen forces, and the emblematic triumph of a lineage that sowed national tragedy. Russ Baker's Family of Secrets is sure to take its place as one of the most startling and influential works of American history and journalism. Well, Russ, I couldn't agree more. In Family of Secrets, obviously the family we're talking about here is the Bush family. I would imagine that a lot of people just want the Bushes to go away, that there's a resistance to looking back. On the other hand, do you feel that we really understand what just happened?
Oh, Bonnie, I think we have no idea what just happened. And in fact, we have no idea what's happening right now. This was one of the, I think, revelations to me as I spent 5 years researching Family of Secrets, was to learn how little even I, an investigative reporter who've been in this business for, you know, 2 decades, how little I understood about the behind-the-scenes efforts to shape our country's destiny and how the Bushes fit into this sort of larger picture. I would say Family of Secrets, it is the Bush family, but it's really the American family and the secrets in our family that have not been fully unearthed up to today.
You know, besides it being about a lot more than, say, the Bush family, maybe they're in the front of it, they're the characters. It's, of course, an incredible study in power. But I was thinking that you could also make a case for claiming that the main character in Family of Secrets is actually the CIA. It seemed as though when you took a closer look at any of the many, many characters that fill the book, There was inevitably a connection to intelligence. Were you surprised at the pervasiveness of intelligence when you were researching this book?
I absolutely was. I mean, I've written about the intelligence community off and on over the years. Back in my days at the Village Voice in the early 90s, I did quite a bit of work. And certainly those of us who have studied the CIA know that it is not only a foreign intelligence organization, even though that's what it's supposed to be, and a foreign covert operations organization, which it is perhaps supposed to be and often not supposed to be, but that it is also an organization with a tremendous amount of influence in this country. I think a lot of us assume that it has no role in this country because by its charter, it's not permitted to have any role. But at several points in its history, it has been discovered that it was it had illegal domestic operations and that it actually had an illegal domestic operations division. And this is quite shocking that they were able to do this and that the entire operation that the entire organization wasn't just shut down. Going back to its founding, Harry Truman very reluctantly agreed to create this peacetime intelligence organization. We had never had one before. He wasn't sure we needed one, and he signed off on it, and then some years later came to regret it, and he said this was a huge mistake. It's interesting, by the way, that the origins of the CIA are very much with the Bush Circle. The architect of the CIA, the man who really put together the blueprint for it, a fellow named Robert Lovett, was a business partner with George W. Bush's grandfather in the investment banking firm of Brown Brothers Harriman. And many of the key figures in its founding and in running it, including perhaps the most influential director ever, Alan Dulles, were all close friends and associates of the Bushes. So they very much go all the way back with this organization. And as I think I document, as you point out, throughout Family of Secrets, the CIA keeps showing up in domestic episodes involving the power in this country, who occupies the White House, who stays in the White House, who leaves the White House prematurely, what these people do in the White House, and so forth.
Well, right. And when you were mentioning in passing the Bush family and one of George H.W. Bush's former business partners having a hand in creating the CIA in the first place, could you describe some of the companies that both Bush the Elder and the son W. either founded or worked for? It seemed to me that the common thread running through both of their business lives is that the companies they were involved with either didn't make a profit, were far too small of enterprises to entail the enormous amount of global travel supposedly required, or in some cases, when queried, the Bushes couldn't remember what they did in these companies. This is a recurring theme, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And actually, that takes place in chapter after chapter of Family Secrets, as you point out, both with the father and the son. Let me just back up a little bit and say that when I began researching Family of Secrets, I did it without any particular agenda in mind. It was 2003. I was living in the former Yugoslavia, training journalists there how journalists could play an important part in building a strong democracy. And while I was there, we had the run up and then the invasion of Iraq, and there was tremendous skepticism, not just there, but all over Europe, wherever I traveled, and a lot more than there was in the United States. And people would say to me, well, how's the press doing in the United States? How are your colleagues doing and holding your own government accountable and trying to figure out what's going on with your own activities? And I realized that I really needed to get back to the States and do my part in this very troubled period. And so when I returned, the first thing I did was I began saying, you know, here's George W. Bush. Now it's 2004. He's on his way to re-election, even despite the fact that he's so controversial already, and at this point there was already some indications that the basis for going to Iraq to war in Iraq were false, and so I decided that I wondered, you know, how did this most improbable of individuals become the most powerful person in the world, and that was a worthy investigation. And so I began just traveling around the country, talking to everybody I could, from people who knew the Bushes to journalists to people in government and so forth, and I got all kinds of different different half-hearted answers, but there would seem to be no consensus, and people didn't really understand it. And so it became very, very clear to me that, in fact, George W. Bush would never have been president if his father had not been president, and that you really needed to look at the continuity of the family and to try to understand what the family as a whole was all about in terms of it being a political force. And so this led me down this kind of rabbit's hole where I discovered that both the father and son had led something of a secret life, and this has to do with some of these companies to which you refer, and that they appeared to be involved in basically in intelligence activities under very, very deep cover, the son to a lesser extent, but particularly the father, and that this predated the father's being, see, you remember he was CIA director in 1976. He served 1 year, and at the time, if you go back and you read the clippings, there was a sort of shock and amazement that they would take this fellow who had really no track record of any note to speak of, and absolutely no experience with intelligence, and right in the middle of all of these church committee hearings into CIA abuses, investigations of a possible involvement with assassinations abroad, investigations into the new investigations of the Kennedy assassination, suddenly they put this guy, Poppy Bush, in to run the CIA. And so I wondered why that was. Well, what I discovered was there is all the evidence points to the fact that he was not, in fact, a neophyte or so-called, quote-unquote, intelligence virgin, but that, in fact, he had been a deep-cover intelligence officer of some sort throughout his entire adult life. And so we see these companies starting with, he gets involved with a company called Dresser Industries, which was actually bought out by Brown Brothers Harriman, was a major player in the international oil industry. And according to documents that I cite in Family Secrets, actually there's acknowledgement that it provided cover for the CIA and played a role in recruiting for the CIA. And then Poppy Bush, that's the nickname for George H.W. Bush to distinguish him from George W., launches this company, Zapata Petroleum, and then Zapata Offshore. And Zapata Offshore, again, is a strange outfit. He goes all over the world. He's got offices everywhere, and he's got very few employees and almost no offshore rigs. So, and they don't make any money. And, of course, all of his filings with the SEC vanish mysteriously. As that's another theme in Family Secrets. All the paperwork about the Bushes keeps vanishing, and fires and accidental destruction of records and so forth. So what we find is that the father, when he became president of the United States, he became president of the United States not as we knew him, as a man who'd been a diplomat and an oilman and a congressman and so forth, but as an intelligence officer brought to that role by this out-of-control agency, very much in the way that we see Vladimir Putin attaining power after being a career KGB officer.
Well, yes, that's absolutely right, and I'm glad you mentioned the fact that Zapata Offshore, for all this traveling he was doing, they had very few actual oil rigs. But I think didn't he have a couple of them placed strategically? One near South America, one in the Caribbean, in places that were strategic for geopolitical purposes.
Right. He had one right off of Cuba, put there at a very sensitive moment, and all the indications are that that was a cover as a staging ground related to what would later be the Bay of Pigs invasion. And in fact, you know, from there I go deeper and deeper, and I realize that the whole life story of George H.W. Bush, which, by the way, he's never really written a full autobiography, and there's a reason for that, is he just cannot, he doesn't have enough cover stories as to what he was supposed to be doing. One of the things that intrigued me very much, and I don't know if you want to talk about that now or later, is what he was doing in 1963.
Oh, yes. Well, I was going to get to that. Actually, we can do that right now, because that brings up what we've been talking about, how he's always sort of there, but not there. I've got a question here. The Kennedy dynasty was snuffed out, and we witnessed the rise of the House of Bush. The nuclear test ban treaty begun by President Kennedy was ultimately discarded by the younger Bush. You discover Bush the Elder lurking in the far background of the Kennedy assassination. A writer for Variety penned a column entitled, "The Man Who Wasn't There." What did this journalist uncover?
Well, he was looking at recently declassified documents that were just vast quantities of them on microfilm, and he was sitting in a library. I tell this story in one of the early chapters of Family of Secrets. He's sitting there looking at this. It's Joe McBride, by the way, and he lives there in the Bay Area, and Joe teaches, or I think he still teaches, at San Francisco State in the film department. And so Joe was looking at these microfilms, and just kind of, he was supposed to be working on a book about Frank Capra, but he was taking a little side journey, as we often do when, you know, we're looking for a distraction. And while he was looking at these things, suddenly he comes upon this document, and it's a reference to it's basically what it is. It's a memo from J. Edgar Hoover, and it is from November 1963, and it says, it references a briefing given on November 23, that's the day after the Kennedy assassination, and it says, basically, to paraphrase, the State Department, according to this memo, was concerned that Cuban exiles in the United States, anti-Castro Cuban exiles, would take the assassination as an invitation to launch an unauthorized invasion of Cuba, and they, of course, thought that could be very, very dangerous, and so they were concerned about that. And so you see, according to this memo, that the FBI being asked to check on this, touched base with a couple of intelligence officers, one a man with military intelligence, and the other George Bush of the CIA. Now, this is very, very interesting, of course, and so McBride's eyes fly wide open, because he finds this in 1988, at which point Poppy Bush, who's currently Vice President of the United States, is on his way to being crowned as the Republican nominee for President of the United States. And he says, oh, my gosh, this guy has had a secret life. And so it's very, very interesting. What does this have to do, not only the fact that he had a secret life, but that this had something to do, it was related, at least tangentially, to the period of the Kennedy assassination. Now, I was very intrigued by this because Poppy Bush has stated in public that he could not remember where he was on November 22, 1963, and it's often astonishing statement. I think probably anybody who was over about the age of 4 or 5 remembers where they were, probably not just in the United States, but anywhere in the world. And so I wondered what that was about. And then there is another document. This one does not relate to the day after the assassination. It relates to the day of the assassination. And this one is also from the FBI, but it's a completely different one. This is from their Houston branch, and it pertains to a telephone call placed at 1:45 p.m. on November 22, shortly after the president has been shot and around the time that the president has been being declared dead. And this says that we received a phone call from Mr. George H.W. Bush, oil man, Zapata offshore from Houston. He called in from Tyler, Texas. This is a town that's near Dallas, to try to offer a tip into a possible suspect in the assassination. So I'm thinking, my God, this is a man who cannot remember where he was. One memo has him working secretly as a CIA officer, having something to do with Cuban exiles who don't like Kennedy. And then the other one has him as a private citizen calling another section of the FBI to offer a tip on the assassination. And I say, well, this is just astonishing. And so I begin looking into that tip. What was that about? Was that a serious tip? What was he doing in Tyler? And this whole story of George H.W. Bush's activities in 1963 and his involvement with this extraordinary web of individuals surrounding the day of the assassination, the CIA, and Lee Harvey Oswald himself, takes up 4 chapters of Family of Secrets, pretty much all new material, never published before elsewhere.
Well, that's right, Russ. I have a sort of general knowledge of a lot of the topics that you cover in Family of Secrets, but I was astounded at the detail and the in-person interviews that you yourself did over, what, the 5 years it took you to write Family of Secrets?
That's right. And so, for example, I managed to even interview a man who, when Mr. Bush called the FBI as a private citizen and pointed out this man who could be a suspect, I traced that and then discovered that Bush's own assistant had been over at the home of the man that he said might be a threat at the precise time that he was calling in this warning, and essentially that man ended up giving the man an alibi. So you've got Bush saying to the FBI, this guy might be a threat. You've got his assistant clearing the guy, and you say, well, what's that about? And the only thing I could conclude based on that and a number of other pieces of evidence that I lay out in Family of Secrets was that this phone call was a red herring designed actually to distract from something else and designed, I think, primarily to create a paper trail, albeit one that remained secret for many, many years before it was finally discovered, that would place Mr. Bush in Tyler, Texas, that is, not in Dallas at the time of the call. And then I don't want to spoil all of the suspense of the book because I did try. It's very complicated material, and there are a lot of names and facts in there, but I try to write a little bit like a thriller. And so I don't want to reveal all of this, but basically there was a reason that he wanted to give the impression that he was not in Dallas at that time.
Exactly. I'm speaking with investigative journalist and author Russ Baker on his new book, Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. You know, Russ, following on what you said about the sort of false paper trails and convoluted allies and movements here and movements there and forgetting about where he was on the day, weaved throughout Family of Secrets, you talk about legends. In an intelligence community, they talk about creating legends. What are those?
I mean, they're basically false stories. This is probably as important as any of the pieces of tradecraft in that profession, that you have to create false stories. I think any of your listeners who are fans of, you know, espionage novels or fictional television shows, you see that these operatives go out with these very extensive cover stories where they're being grilled about things, and they've got fake photos of them with people who weren't really their parents, and they're supposed to be a child, you know, when they were a child, and being asked to recount obscure stories. Stories about things that had supposedly happened years ago that had never happened, so that if they're ever caught or grilled, their cover will hold up. Well, this is what you see. This is the way it really is. And so in the Bush family, you see that they've all got these cover stories, and they're quite extensive, and they can't even just do it themselves. In one of those four Kennedy-related chapters in Family Secrets, I've got Barbara Bush, who remarkably, she's quite a tough lady, and she has written this letter. Well, I wouldn't say she wrote a letter. There's a letter that appears. She writes this this sort of a selective memoir, and it comes out right after her husband loses to Bill Clinton, and all of these records about the Kennedy assassination are being declassified. Oliver Stone's movie came out, and there was this groundswell of support. I think it was a unanimous vote. The House of Representatives never votes unanimously on anything, but there was so much public pressure, they voted unanimously to release these records. And so in there were some of these memos relating to Poppy Bush. And so here comes along Barbara, right around that time, and she releases this memoir, and she suddenly remembers where they were on November 22, 1963, and she's got the so-called letter, which she's recreating 40 years later, in which she describes getting her hair done in Tyler, Texas, and how she heard about it on the radio and so forth, and that letter in itself has a bunch of what seem to be red herrings that I tracked down and tried to sort of unravel.
Yes, the false clues, and that was very interesting how you took that apart. You know, Russ, before we finish the Kennedy assassination, well, there's just so much to go through. We could do show after show after show on your book because it covers, like, practically all of the 20th century history of the United States, and then, of course, almost 10 years into the 21st century. One thing, you know, there were so many details in your book that are so shocking. And I just want to recount one of them back to November 22nd, 1963. You have a quote from Lyndon Baines Johnson in your book, calling on the phone from Parkland Hospital in Dallas just as Jack Kennedy is pronounced dead. Johnson is calling his tax attorney, and he is overheard on the phone saying, "Oh, I gotta get rid of my goddamn Halliburton stock." And that's just one quote from Johnson on this incredible day when I should find the page in your book where he's referring to the Kennedy assassination as just some murder and people shouldn't be wasting too much time on it.
Extraordinary stuff. That quote, by the way, is again like I believe every quote in the book. It's on the record. I don't believe in using anonymous sources unless it's absolutely necessary. And so I work very, very hard to get my sources to go on the record. And that's an on the record quote from an attorney who actually worked in a major firm in Dallas, was an attorney for the Republican Party and worked with Poppy Bush and some other folks, and he was a partner in a firm with the man who handled LBJ's money, and he told me this story that the call had been going through, and it was a historic moment, and he was a friend of the telephone operator there at the firm, and because they were friends, she just thought it was a historic call. She didn't expect anything sensitive to be in there, and she let him listen in, and he heard these shocking words. And so there you have not just the incredible sort of callousness of LBJ, but you also have and whatever implications one might draw from that as he was becoming president as a result of this remarkable series of events, but also the name Halliburton. And of course many of your listeners may know that Halliburton, a major oil field services firm, in the 1990s, a group of people who had control of the firm turned to a fellow named Dick Cheney and asked him if he would like to run it, and of course this set him up for life. This enriched him greatly. Halliburton, by the way, was merged with a company called Brown and Root, which is KBR. Again, your listeners may know them for their very controversial contract work in Iraq, including the electrification of a number of servicemen through faulty wiring. KBR, Halliburton, and Dresser Industries, the Bush family company, all having been merged into one at one point in that period.
Well, yes, and they figure in the no-bid contracts in the Vietnam War as well as Iraq. I mean, it's the same people, the same companies, the same stuff that goes all through your book. You look at the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same group.
It is, and it's the same group that's still getting all the contracts with Barack Obama as president.
Right. I want to just very quickly read paragraph on page 132, because this Lyndon Johnson stuff is so astonishing. It says, there are many other examples of LBJ's apparent unconcern after the assassination, though none so immediate. For instance, on the evening of November 25th, LBJ and Martin Luther King talked, and LBJ said, quote, it's just an impossible period. We've got a budget coming up. That morning, he told Joe Alsop that, quote, the president must not inject himself into local killings, to which Alsop immediately replied, I agree with that, but in this case it does happen to be the killing of the president. Also on the same day, LBJ told Hoover, we can't be checking up on every shooting scrape in the country. I mean, these are just unbelievable remarks.
They're really, you can't make this stuff up.
No, you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
One other thing before we leave 1963 and in Dallas, and of course, oh my gosh, you've got such incredible information on that. The cast of characters, the white Russians, intelligence.
Well, without going into too much detail on this, how about the fact that there was a kind of a father figure in Lee Harvey Oswald's life in the year prior to the assassination? I don't think many people know that, and I don't think many people know anything about that there was such a man, who he was, or that he was an old friend of Poppy Bush's.
You're talking about George de Morenschild.
That's right.
Oh, yes. Why don't you tell us about him? He's one of the most colorful characters in the book.
Yeah, well, this is what I had to do to try to understand and unravel this connection. What did it mean that the man who was sort of practically driving Lee Harvey Oswald to work, finding him apartments and sort of babysitting him, a man who's been sort of ignored by history, what did it mean that he and Poppy Bush went all the way back to the 1940s together and had stayed in touch, and and Poppy couldn't remember where he was that day? What did this mean? And so I needed to understand de Morenschild. Now, there's been a little bit written about him, but if you look at the, let's say 1,000 plus books on the Kennedy assassination, probably 5 of them or 10 of them have a reference to him, and most of them are very, very brief. Norman Herman Mailer was fascinated by DeBoer, and Shulton wrote something about him. But none of these books got into the areas that I go into. I've got an entire chapter of Family Secrets just on George DeBoer and Shulton, where I reconstruct his whole life and his path to the United States and into the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. And this unearths this whole backstory of how the United States had a covert pipeline, if you will, a sort of a kind of an underground railroad bringing staunch anti-communist Russians, starting in the early 1920s, to the United States and settling them in Dallas, which would become a rising center of oil finance, settling them there, and then creating this little tiny but very, very powerful community that then intermarried with some of the wealthiest families in Texas. A whole history not even known today, just completely not known, and these people all seem to have intelligence connections, particularly George DeMoor and Shulton. Some chapters later in the book, I bring it forward where George DeMoor and Shulton, now we're in the 1970s, and he's terrified because he feels that some people are after him, and he writes a letter to his old friend Poppy Bush, now head of the CIA, and he says, "Could you please do something to stop this?" Poppy writes back and says, you know, basically saying, "You know, I think you're imagining something. I've checked it out. There's no problem." Well, 6 months later, George DeMoor and Shulton is dead of a shotgun blast to the head.
And let's have a music break.